Blog Talk Radio.
Inca stonework. Inca stonework is stonework that doesn't have mortar in between, because all of the stones fit like a jigsaw puzzle against one another. And that seems to be the ideal in buntings, where the words fit against each other so that there's no, they're seamless. Like if in Greg Flats, his poem of that the era, the 60s, he has a verse describing a cart rolling through countryside on an old road, and the entire landscape and the nature of the cart and the nature of the road are described in four or five words with what a fellow mutters to Axel, rut thuds the rim. And it was that rut thuds the rim that really blew my mind, because it's these four like Anglo-Saxon words, rut thuds the rim, you get a picture of the road, the rut. The rim gives you the cart, the nature of the cart and the wheels of the cart. Thuds gives you the whole physical jar and motion of the car going through ruts in a country road. And it's sort of what I meant by Inca stonework, rut thuds the rim. There's four words, three of which are very heavy, solid vowels, rut thuds rim. And in that, you get a picture of the whole landscape. So that's how I understood his notion of condensation. And I use that line in teaching still, because it's so obvious and so jarring in a sense.
Welcome to Late Night Poets. And I am your host, Richard Weissman. And we are In Our Craft or Sullen Art. And my co-host, Neutron Bomb, is still on hiatus, but Ham Ray has agreed to be our substitute co-host for the evening. And so I am going to bring Pam on. Here she is. Hi,
hello.
Pam.
Hey, Richard. How's it going?
Good, good. So that was Allen Ginsberg introducing us to our featured poet, Basil Bunting, who you actually chose as our topic for the night.
Yes, yes. I liked, you know what, that was a great choice for an intro because, you know, I read that Allen Ginsberg, and I can't remember who else, but one of the other beat poets at least, maybe more, thought that during his time, Basil Bunting was an unappreciated poetic genius. And so I thought, I saw that earlier, when you had posted in Speakeasy, and I listened and I thought, wow, that is a really great choice to have an audio of, you know, of Allen Ginsberg talking about Basil Bunting's poetic style. So very cool. I like that.
Cool. Yeah. And I liked what he was saying too, that just like the power of that late modernist style, the kind of, you know, less words to convey more truth. I forget how he put it in the beginning exactly, but something like Rick's being kind of custom fit, so they don't need mortar. They don't need, you know, some type of glue mechanism. They don't need that.
Like he was talking about some sort of ancient Aztec or something like that.
Yeah. Yep.
But I have to tell you, it was fun picking out a prompt for your show, but it wasn't easy. I actually went through, in my mind, several, plus actually physically looking up different quotes, I from different authors that I considered before settling on Basil Bunting. But it was so much fun, and I'm thank you so much for allowing me to choose the topic, because it was fun searching and finally deciding on one.
Yeah, and I have to say, from my perspective, it made everything real easy because normally I've got to like pick out the author or the poet and then find quotes and, you know, try and make them so that they're easy for our poets to get inspired by, because even though something might be brilliant and brilliantly written, it might not be such great inspiration for poetry. So you did all that legwork for me.
That is so true.
I just had to show up. So as of right now, we actually just had our first call-in besides us, obviously. So let me bring them on the air. 470 area code. You are on the air.
Well, it's Fallon.
Hey, Fallon.
Hey, Fallon.
How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing well.
All right.
So I'm guessing that you just called in. You might not have heard the opening clip.
No, I didn't. I apologize.
Okay. That's okay. We actually just were kind of winding up talking about it anyway, so we're ready to move forward. Now, the question I always ask when we have someone call in, are you in a rush? Do you need to read and run? Or can you hang out for a while?
I'm here to support and hang out.
Okay, great. In that case, Pam, I am turning the board over to you.
All right. Well, we are going to start the show with "Will You Take the High Road or Low Road Now" by Eric Swenson. And we have an audio for that, so go ahead, Richard, whenever you're ready.
Yep, we do. Okay, so I am just about to pull it up.
Will you take the high or low road now? Bedraggled boudoir, mangled by time, frayed curtains bade despair. Beyond repair the furniture, faded sepia prints bleed futility. Ill dispute not hard to camouflage these days. Libertine values always questioned by prudes. Liquor looks past tired old flesh, pallid blade, pale rouge cheeks become palatable. Alas, the birth pangs of this Third World War are too much to bear. Bedraggled bourgeois world remembers the result of madmen. Drink a dram or two to subdue the harlot's sickly apparel. So my uncle, who served in the North African campaign, told me a woman tied underneath a donkey. Boudoir world now all shaken up. News on television and radio sticks like gas. Phlegm. Cough harder, man. Spit blood. Vomit. Comatose comet, you pacifist. Take sides like a clan member. Wear the skirt. Eat dirt. Not petite, more pity cake. Bedraggled boudoir world needs you to be present. Shame makes for lame shambles. Get on a ruddy soapbox. Speak out. Fight this new bedraggled boudoir madness. Confess your fears, man. You're no longer the shy young man on his first visit to a house of ill dispute, are you? The hour is never too late. Don't odolisk like a bag of rotten potatoes. potatoes on the couch. Poetry is a condition, not a profession. Pull yourself together, man. Prepare for nuclear fallout. Mangled hope sinks to the bottom of many kegs. Wine, ale, spirits, the worst. Mind's haggis. Swollen stomach, belch, blue fumes. Pallid, flayed, pale rose cheeks no longer charm. Red herrings cajole priests, poets, prostitutes, and the destitute. Bordellos mushroom like salmon eggs. Conspiracies multiply. The old way hung out to dry like peppered mackerel. Bitter Scottish eggs boiled blue. Haggis, mines, comatose, frayed flags, give up the ghost. Be a true poet, speak up, man. Info.
Thank you for the SoundCloud, Eric. Boy, Eric just delivers for this show every 2 weeks, and I love how, so unfortunately, if you're not on All Poetry, you're not following along visually with us, but along with the poem, he actually added a cover of a book of poetry by Basil Bunting, and it includes a photo of Basil Bunting, and my gosh, what a dramatic-looking dude. If ever someone looked like a poet, it was this gentleman that we are featuring tonight, and a beautiful poem inspired by Prompt 9, which was, "The times are squalid, they always were. It is a poet's duty to hold the line." And I thought this was a tough poem to mirror our tough times. Especially appreciated, "Alas, the birth pangs of this Third World War are too much to bear. The draggled boudoir world remembers the result of madmen." And my hope is that we may somehow avert this prophecy. Things are tough now with Putin and his insanity, but so far things haven't gone all that way into Third World War apocalyptic, so hopefully it'll resolve itself as quickly and painlessly as possible. And Felon, what'd you think?
I'll just read what I wrote to him about this mm-hmm. when I read it the first 7 days ago. I said, "The way you sink your teeth into wording reality, it's a bite I long for that impression. Unique and very intelligent when reading without conviction. We are a society with one foot in the grave, dying on opinions to buried facts, allowing a narrative biology to become reality to just a thought. Excuses used to invade on the rights on what was, offended when others don't agree with what's perceived, labeling others from their own insecurities. When will it stop? And maybe I should just take up drinking too. Just maybe then it can alter my perception to the world on the brink of death." Yeah, great job.
What a great comment, Felon. Dynamite. Mm-hmm. And Pam, I will give you final word on this piece.
Yeah, you know, I have to agree that with Felon, it has plenty of bite to it. It's really, it's hard-hitting. It's emotionally intense. I like how he's got some short, impactful lines. I really like that, to me, that the main message of this is how the voice of the poet, which much stand up and speak out during any difficult time, and as you mentioned, Richard, especially right now. You know, I really like the beginning, you know, with the bed rang of boudoir, mangled by time, frayed curtains, bay, despair, beyond repair, the furniture faded, sepia, prints, bleed, futility. So it seems like everything's hopeless. And then
there's those, that moment of, you know, stand up, you know, get off your butt and, you know, stand on that soapbox and speak up, because that's what you're supposed to do. You know, in that end, trade flags, give up the ghost, be a true poet, speak up, man. I love that as an ending line, be a true poet, speak up, man. I really think he captures the spirit of the idea that poetry is more than just pretty words put on paper. So excellent writing, very well done.
Absolutely great insights. Okay, with that, we are ready to flow on to our next one.
All right, well, we do have a couple of carryovers from the last show. So,
yep.
And which was, oh, yes, Flannery and O'Connor, or Flannery O'Connor and Harper Lee. My apologies.
Yep.
And we have Picture Frame by Ursula McCabe. And Richard, will you give that a read, please?
Yeah, and I wanted to just take a moment, because the funny thing is we had two carryovers, and these happened to be metal poems.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, this was actually the goal. I was incredibly impressed by this one. So it's called Picture Frame by Ursula McCabe, and it goes like this. Scattered on top of white sand, flat black rocks are the size of silver dollars, perfect fit for vest pockets. We walk, we run, we trot. Some of us hide, and some of us swim through the tide till we grow up and turn into fishermen, standing shadow still, arms balancing, whip-thin fishing poles. Lazy conifers dot the top of coastal mountains. Their twisted crowns are furry eyebrows holding up the sun. A lone horsetail cloud floats by and asks, have you done your best? Because this is the time. Right now, all I need is to fit this small inlet into a picture frame. Beyond here, I don't know how the sea will act. But today, the waves are quiet, satisfied. End of show. Cam, I'm going to give you first word on this one.
All right. Well, wonderful read there, Richard. I have to say, great gold. Well, you know, it was just an absolutely well-deserved gold. This is brilliant with her word choicing. To me, I thought it had beautiful and brilliant imagery and metaphors, and spoke on the growth of the heart that helps us appreciate the stunning beauty of the moment. You know, it takes us from childhood, where there's a sense of innocence, to adulthood, where there's almost like a sense of, well, I don't know if bitterness is the right word. And then that realization, that growth that comes with, you know, with the ending, but today the waves are quiet, satisfied. And I like that whole time that she uses almost like an extended metaphor of being at the ocean and growing throughout life. I especially like the imagery in a lone horsetail cloud floats by and asks, have you done your best? Because this is the time. Wonderful line, beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. And Fallon, your thoughts?
This is a very very well-deserving of the gold for me. You can't fit everything in a picture frame, but yet we are – what's left of us when we're gone is going to be what we see in a picture frame. You know, you want to make sure that you get that best shot, you know, from the time that you're a child and that you're just standing in the waves to the point that you're actually feasting upon what's coming from the waves or the ocean. You never really realize everything that's how things change over the years, and that before you look back, you're like, man, where did the waves go? Because they're all still in, you know, everything's still. And it's the last curve. So this is just a reality in your face kind of don't let time pass by without making good memories. So excellent job.
Absolutely. Another amazing and on point comment. Thanks, Fallon. Obviously, we not only gave this a medal, we gave this the gold. And I just thought that this take on the prompt was so spot on. And the prompt was, in yourself right now is all the place you've got to be. And I think she did such a wonderful job of showing what's going on in this place right now and doing it through this powerful series of metaphors to literally paint a picture with words and then frame it. I don't know, it was just breathtaking. And when I read it a couple of times, it kind of left me speechless. I was like, damn, that is a good take on the prompt. And I think the other thing that I appreciated is how just different. It's not minimalistic, but it's just there's no extraneous material. Through nature, she is able to paint that picture, and it is a picture of who she is in this frame that she's offering to us. So I thought it was brilliant, brilliant poetry. One of the reasons why I love doing this every 2 weeks. Okay, Pam. And I know we had another carryover.
Yes, we have My Dreams Don't Hold Me As Tight As They Once Did by Julie Buck. And Fallon, would you give that a read for us, please?
You already know I will.
Absolutely.
My girl, Julie Buck. My dreams don't hold me as tight as they once did. My dreams don't hold me as tight as they once did. Perhaps comes with age and, oh yeah, the falling off the grid thing. I'm apart from. Does that sound glum? Well, shoot me now, brown cow. Moo, I say moo. I'd like a jaunt to when glue held me together and not guilt. But even glue ain't as strong as it used to be. Ever notice that? Sadder yet, the permanent in my Sharpies are no longer permanent. Yeah. Can't trust anything anymore. Oops, I dropped something on the floor. Looks like my fate. And even in disguise. But thanks. No freaking surprise. End point.
Great read, Fallon. And not an easy poem to read. So admirable job there. And Pam, if you could get us started off with comments.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that is a well-deserved silver. Julie, when she writes, she really packs a punch. I like how she has a kind of almost sardonic, biting quality to it. I like how this comes across about the bitterness of life and how that unfortunately experiences teach you not to trust people. I like especially... I like anytime anybody brings up cows and poems, obviously, with, shoot me now, brown cow, moo, I say moo, I'd like a jaunt too when the glue held me together and not guilt. I like that idea of, when I was a stronger person, but I'm not anymore, or when I was a nicer person, a happier person, but I'm not anymore because that's the way life made me, I like that she brings up the Sharpie. Sadder yet, the permanent in my Sharpies are no longer permanent. You just realize that realization that there are so many things out there in life that are not going to last. And it's none of the twists and turns seem to take you as a surprise as much. So just an amazing write by Julie and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, I too really love this piece. I thought the rhyming scheme just in general was incredibly skillful. But in this context, in the context of what she's doing in the poem, I thought that it served to to color and underline the message, as well as in this kind of, you know, paradoxical and undercurrent way, lighten it up, but lighten it up in a kind of Dorothy Parker-esque kind of manner, you know, where it's like there's this biting, sardonic, wry humor, just very skillful, and I thought very well deserving of the silver. So, just a great, great poem. And Fallon, as our reader, I will give you final word on the piece.
Okay, if I may, I would like to, quote the prompt, because I think that would be best to understand a lot of this. It says, "You really never understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb inside his skin and walk around in it," by Harper Lee. That's true. And I think she very was a genius in the way she put this together, because she basically was like thought after thought after thought, fleeting things like the carelessness of this to that, you know, and how sometimes things just don't hold together the way you think they're going to hold together. And things are not permanent, as you say, "Oh, I'll never do this," but guess what? You're doing it again. So I told her basically this. I said, "Oh, wow, how you can snatch them up by the back of the neck. You hit so hard at times, that left me to look around and even see if you were watching me. Raw reality to life always finds ink within your rights." And that is true. She is a hard hitter and to be reckoned with, always in writing.
Absolutely. Yeah, great comment. Yeah, and it was a very skillful pick on the prompt. Okay, Pam, where would you like to go?
All right, we are now into Bays of Bunting-inspired rites, and I have put up Delight in Transience by Anton Ansford, 37, and it goes like this. "Sagra de Familia may soon be completed, which is a shame, as unfinished is how it was meant to be. My first career was in Egyptology. The Egyptians were afraid of extinction and became monuments to fertility. And the stench of death, a poem, is like a mandala or a sandcastle, one moment of beauty determined to be destroyed." End poem.
Great read, Pam. Yeah, I love that. "And the stench of death, poem, is like a mandala or a sandcastle, one moment of beauty determined to be destroyed." And to me, this kind of like had that Ozymandias feel to it, where, you know, here's this thing that seems like it's going to last. Egyptology always makes me think of not only the pyramids, but what's inside those pyramids and the tombs, you know, the pharaohs in their mummified form, trying not to be destroyed, trying not to be a sandcastle and not making it. So I thought it was all very skillfully put together. Spotlight on the transitory nature of all things, including art as well. I thought it was some strong existential philosophical musings. Very well done. And Fallon, your thoughts on it?
I was taken back by this piece, just going back over it again. The way they break this down in just a very word is very powerful, because, you know, to say that someone's poetry is like that of Mandela, that is, you know, it's something to be worshipped and something that people look up to, but yet at the same time it can be so fragile as a sandcastle, and it just takes one powerful wind or one big wave and it's gone. But yet the thing of it is, it's still instilled in whoever read it. So that's what I gathered from it. This is just an amazing piece.
That was some great insights. And Pam, I'll give you final word.
Yeah, this is a wonderful brevity. And yes, it definitely does speak very well on the idea that, the beauty, the joy and beauty of family and poetry and so many things in life
is a very fleeting moment, then it's heading towards destruction. You know, and I do like this all the way through. But, yeah, especially that mention of the Egyptian tombs. The Egyptians were afraid of extinction and became monuments to futility. You know, and I think that represents how even nowadays we have that fear of death. We have that fear of, you know, not leaving everything in order. So wonderful, right, and very well done.
Excellent comment. Okay, I think we're ready for our next one.
All right. And up next we have No Cinderella Slipper by Ken Smith. And Richard, go ahead and give that a read, please.
Okay, so yeah, this is Ken Smith. It's called No Cinderella Slipper. Now was then, not now. The blacksmith's hammer lifts and drops. Sparks fly from the glowing metal. The shoe banged and bent. No longer fits the horse, No Cinderella Slipper. The wordsmith's pen can only push the cart downhill. There is no turning back. Grains of sand can smooth a stone, a blood-red apple picked and shined. Remains removed forever. The poem descends to its last line, a slot that is a grave. End of poem. And that was to quote two, which is, stones indeed sift to sand. Oak bends with the saint's bones. And Fallon, let's start comments with you, if we may.
Yeah, I like this part where here it says, sparks fly from the glowing metal, the shoe banged and bent, the longer fits the horse, No Cinderella Slipper. I basically tell him, you know, molding to fit a walk along life often leaves us barefoot and, you know, leaves us bare because it, sometimes the shoe wasn't made for us and the happily ever after is not made for us. And yet sometimes the walk is not made for us. And sometimes we don't have to carry everybody's load. So sometimes we're just a little bare and we just have to just, you know, keep on the journey that we're on, whether it's with shoes or without. So this is just a very powerful light.
Great insights there. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is another one that's a powerful brevity. I like how he always has this strong imagery and short, impactful lines. And the main message that I got from this was the idea that, you know, that change will happen whether or not we want it to. And I really like that he went with the representation of the blacksmith's hammer lifts and drops, you know, because the blacksmith has to work with the metal in the moment. It can't wait, you know, he may have to wait a bit because it has to be that kind of perfect malleable temperature. And to me, the blacksmith kind of represented a god or a higher power creating the change. And, you know, and I could be wrong, obviously, but it does happen. And we just have, you know, are part of that change. But at the same time, there are things that are beyond our control. So excellent, right, and very well done.
Excellent insights. Yeah, I think, you know, I like that interpretation. And I thought I too really enjoyed this piece. I thought there were wonderful metaphors throughout the brevity that explore the nature of action, fate, impermanence, and art. I thought it was a really strong philosophical piece, as his work is. You know, he tends to be quite a philosophical writer. Okay, Pam, who's next?
All right, up next we have Blah, Blah, Blah by Colap, and we have an audio for that whenever you're ready, Richard.
Okay, yep, let me pull it up. And by the way, thanks for for giving me a heads up about that, because I read it, like, I don't know, maybe a week ago or something like that, and it didn't have an audio at that time. So thanks for having my back. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're definitely welcome.
Okay, here it goes.
Of Fairies and Tales by Colab. A tiara for your daughter placed on her head. This constructs her life around a pack of lies. Blah, blah, blah. Prince Charming, close your eyes. Kiss the frog, he'll become Mr. Hyde. Or Dracula sucking your vitality dry. Dress her pink. Teach her curtsy. Pretty please, brush ultra bright smile. A dimple on each side. Any passerby could be the man of your life. But love in its romantic construction was just a medieval concoction born of another reading of the Bible. All of a sudden women were seen more equal to men than swords and halberds clashed, all in the name of a perfume of a certain lady soaked on a handkerchief. The English word itself has the sound of an uncontrollable letting out of air. Try making the sound as you read this from a mouth that doesn't hold the weight of a feeling, a sentiment so strong that wars were waged, Trojan for one. Love is overrated and doesn't carry the weight of a compassion, a feeling that has elements of love but goes above and beyond from the personal to the collective, conjuring the idea of reaching out to help just by placing yourself in the spot of the beloved holds a grander notion for salvation rather than the selfish te quiero, a desire to possess a need that has the color of conquest. Love is overrated. How about we just delete that word from the English language, replace it with I care for you and will be there for you through thick and thin, but only if you're kind to me. Or else it would be too convenient to hold on to this holy institution, now outdated, being shattered to smithereens by more pressing crises like global warming. To be honest, I prefer to keep the bull alive and spare me all this beef. End of poem.
Thank you for the SoundCloud collab. That actually added quite a nice other layer to have that audio and hear the poet reading her own work. Great. And Felon, if we can start comments off with you, what'd you think?
I am left like, oh my God. This is just constructed very well, and yes, so that not reading it would not have put it what needed to be done to it. And so that being said, the tiara for your daughter placed upon her head, blah, 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 that just basically says you can tell her she's a princess and she's going to get her prince, but blah, 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 blah is all it is because it's not guaranteed. And then it goes on to, you know, put her in a pink dress, make her look curtsy, put her on that extra smile. You know, any man passerby is going to want her. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to value her. And then it goes on to the being the love and the romantics, and some people are made it too into ready-made marriage that, you know, the push into the already, it's already pre-known who you're going to and what you have to do for the rest of your life or how your life is going to be. And then because love is not a word in their vocabulary, they're not allowed to speak it because it's really not love. It's just for convenience. It's for money or it's for, you know, family sake or just that of tradition. And it goes on, you know, it is overrated. Because people, love is today is not seen as unconditional because there's always conditions to anything. I'll love you until you do this, and I'll love you until that. And then it comes down to the very end, you know, she said, you know what, the holy institution is so outdated, and I agree. And it is shattered smithereens, and we're more worried about the damn global warming than we are with the society and the way that we perceive one another and the love that we can give each other. This is just an amazing poem, and yeah, spare me the beef. I don't want to eat it either. Great job.
Absolutely great, great insights. Yeah, I too love this piece, and I know the word love is all about it, but I thought they were really well-reasoned musings on the topic of love, and I liked how she took it from courtly love, romantic construction, and Prince Charming, close your eyes, kiss the frog, to the pop cultural idea of true love being dependent on an ultra bright smile and the whole way that the advertising industry and global corporate entities manipulate our insecurities regarding love in order to sell their products. She gives the topic a good chewing, and I thought it was very well done. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yes. Well, first of all, I'd like to apologize because when I introduced the poem, I did forget to mention that Kolap had told me that this is a collaboration between her and Mark Loopy. So I'd like to say great writing to both of them because, it's extremely seamless in its presentation with a consistent tone. You know, I really like this had a strong voice with a feminist undertone to it. The idea of how young girls are put on, have those tiaras put on, those glass slippers, you know, and told to go out there and, you know, get their Prince Charming and what they're supposed to do. I also like that she wrote, they wrote in a very straightforward style. And it opens minds up to the harsh reality of love and fairy tales, that love doesn't always happen the way it does in fairy tales. And I like that she reminds us that in modern days, you know, it's not that fairy tale story. It's, you know, and even the word love is overrated because it can be so easily said without action being put behind it. So, you know, just a wonderful write and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comments. Okay. And where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have The Collector by Daniel Descino. And Felon, will you give that a read for us, please?
I will do my best. This is by Daniel Descino. It's called The Collector. I seen garage sale gold and sidewalk silver, porch weathered platinum, and basement bronze. It's only recently that I realized it was something more than just rocks. I have schoolyard skimmishes and businessmen bullies, neighborhood Nazis and leadership leeches. I finally see the truth as fear and hatred powered soulless conceptions and glooms, and they are all the same. It takes age to appreciate age. It shouldn't be. It does. It takes sickness to appreciate health. Why won't the young and the healthy listen? It takes light to appreciate day. Why do I not notice the colors when I could have? And when the summer sidewalk radiates, I dream of snow shoveling frozen fingers. At least I used to. Now, well, I only want now. I've always been a collector. I just didn't always know it. As a wanderer, a traveler, monk, one day realized he is happy. Tools in the toolbox only help a carpenter. End point.
Great read, Felon. And Pam, if we could start comments off with you.
Yeah, that was definitely a great read there, Felon. I really like this. I like how the title, The Collector, and how it's about collecting observations, you know, going for walks and basically about people watching. But it's more than that. It's a deeply layered write that was amazing and heartfelt on the idea of a mind that becomes open to beauty unseen before, but also perhaps, you know, darkness unseen before, the ugliness in humanity. And I really like it takes age to appreciate age. It shouldn't, but it does. It takes sickness to appreciate health. You know, that whole stanza reminding us that it's so true. Oftentimes it's not until, you know, us or someone else becomes severely ill or, you know, that we really appreciate what we had before. You know, just an amazing write and very well done.
Great comment there, Pam. Yeah, and this is based upon prompt 8, the corkscrews I carry are experience and knowledge. The problem is they don't fit every bottle, and sometimes they break the cork. And yeah, I was struck by that same passage. It takes age to appreciate age. It shouldn't, but it does. It takes sickness to appreciate health. And what the young and healthy listen, it takes night to appreciate day. Why did I not notice the colors when I could have? And boy, this is, you know, it's somber and it's wise. It's strong philosophical musings and existential happiness are hard for and gained through the examined life. And as always, Daniel just brings it every 2 weeks for us, and this was no exception, incredibly powerful work. And Felon, I'll give you final word as reader.
This is another amazing write. You know, it's funny how the way he put his wording to that prompt, because we are a collector of things, and sometimes we don't realize the things that we have collected over the years, and it's not things that are materialistic, it's things that we collect within ourselves, and sometimes it can come a little crowded and we don't really realize what we have inside. And it, you know, when does it take for us to realize all the things we have in that toolbox? Only when we can't lift it anymore, or we can't even use the tool. You know, we need to start taking more inventory of what we have, you know, in order to build a better life. So I think this is just very philosophical. I think it's just a lot to take in, and really just eye opening for those, you know, above 50, because we don't have a whole lot of time. And this just reminds us, you know, even if the sun shines on the concrete, find beauty in it, because one day you might not see it. So this is just wow. Great job, Daniel.
Absolutely. Great comment there, Felon. Okay, Pam.
Yes, I am definitely impressed with tonight's lineup of poetry. Very cool. And up next we have Space Goo by Pee Wee Kusin. And Richard, go ahead and give that a read for us, please.
Yeah, this is a nice counterpoint. And I will point out, once again, in our Crafter Soul and Arm, we got another one of our inspired by front page picks 2 days ago. This was a front page pick and well-deserved. It's called Space Goo by Pee Wee Kusin. And it goes like this. Fortuitous fornicators riding on greatly exaggerated galactic gators, copiously conquering, dimensionally defensive, diplomatic droids with herniated hemorrhoids, craving clusters of constellations and non-existent nebulous nations, incessantly impeding the solitude of solitary somnambulist society stations. Trigonometric trisomy is the key voluptuousness of valiumed vixens commands you to clean the kitchen, cook and clean and coalesce, dignitaries deem dignity less. Lesbos through Lebanon constitutes Earth's erogenous hard-on, vestigial vector vindicated, vacuous space vagina, undertow underneath Uranus is right behind ya. Insistent on insanity, but humbling for humanity. Contemporary calculator is a disastrously diseased by the Earth's STDs. Looking upward, keeping nicked up knees, gelatinous goop on everything it sees, fellatio frequency for the fall, intrinsically inept, right in the eyeball. Planetary prostitution is just a slum solution. Systematically soluble, some strings, be still beholding and breathtaking. Tastes like coconut water, it said. I'm told it really stings. End of poem. Okay. Pam, let's start comments with you.
Well, great read there, Richard. That, you know, between the alliteration and the wordplay, there were definitely some challenging lines there. And I do like that he seems to have had fun with words, you know, like he and phrasings. And it's always a good thing to see with poets. He wrote to the prompt one, which was dirty little words, dirty long words, which is not the full prompt. It was, let's see here, if I'll just click it up. So it's more in context with the prompt. Nasty little words, nasty long words, it's unhealthy. I want to wash when I meet a poet, which was from the poem What the Chairman Told Tom by Basil Bunting. And I like that he took a lot of words and a lot of phrases that might be frowned upon, you know, and reminded us that they're just as much a part of life. But I kind of felt like there was this this message on, you know, how we are, you know, destroying ourselves, how we're destroying our world. And then the idea that we want to, you know, like the idea that of considering, you know, what planet can we move to next? And it's like, well, why not take care of the one you're on? Not that it isn't, you know, interesting to dream about, you know, other planets and exploring space and the universe. But, you know, instead of getting the other one, this one all filthy and moving on, you know, take care of it, you know. And I could be reading that wrong, but that's the kind of idea I get. And I also like, it makes me smile that there's so much imagery in here that has that feel of the 1950s, 1960s, like B-rated movies, you know, with like sexy women aliens, you know. And so just a clever write and very well done.
Absolutely, great comment. And I, too, really enjoyed this one. I think that, you know, not just Basil Bunting, but I think in general that our show kind of invites heavy writes. And so it's always nice when someone figures out a way to lighten it up and bring us a fun, funny poem. And this one really did provide that change of pace. And as the reader, I will have to say that it wasn't easy with the alliterations and wordplay. But it was well worth the trip. I thought it was fun, funny, rhyming poem with a great rhyming scheme, which is not easy to do, and it was enjoyable to read, which is always a nice thing. And Felon, I'll give you final word. What'd you think?
I was really taken back by this poem, insistent on insanity, but humbly for humanity. Contemporary calculator is a meticulous masturbator, distressfully diseased by Earth's STDs. And to me, what I really got out of this was the fact that, you know, as he starts it off too, you know, saying it's an accidentally effing, if you know what I mean, is what he's saying, you know, humping going on. But it's in that we, the gators is such a powerful bite that, you know, sometimes we don't realize that we're screwing ourselves out of so much. And at the end of the day is, you know, then when he says, talks about the lesbos through Lebanon, you know, it's also setting up for, you know, those who are, you know, wanting this to be just like this and don't care about anybody else's rights. It's not really going to matter because, you know what, if we don't get this thing together, we're going to F ourselves out of a planet and that of humanity. So just an excellent poem.
Absolutely. Great comment. Okay, Pam, where would you like to go?
All right. Up next, we have Who's It About by Thomas B. And it goes like this. You think love comes easily. It will happen without the blisters that bleed from gardening after winter's hardened hopes. Softened hands and you hopelessly prepare for summer's weeds, autumn's rewards. Hoe to aerate, hoe to get rid of weeds. Patience expires, gardens rarely care. Santa shows up for cookies and cream, all the presents, no more than drifts of dreams. The tree slowly becomes the fire hazard, a nuisance at the curb. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Okay, so let me look and see what I was thinking on this one. Yeah, you know, I like the fact that he looked at more than one prompt and, you know, gave us kind of like more of a synthesis of the prompts, always a nice way to go with it. So he says this is inspired by 8 and then goes on to 9, but not quite to 10. So 8 was, I'm looking at my notes here. So 8 was always carry a corkscrew and the wine shall provide itself. And 9 was the times are squalid, they always were, is the poet's duty to hold the line. So, yeah, I thought the metaphor is well woven and the seasons of life come to life. The seasons of life are brought to life quite exquisitely in this brevity. He does quite a bit with very few words, and that's always impressive. It never ceases to amaze me how much people can do in these brevities, and Thomas really does bring it in this brevity. So quite well done. And Felon, your thoughts?
I like the way he starts this out, basically. You think your love comes easily, it will happen without blisters that bleed from gardening after winter's hardened hopes soften your hands. Basically, he's saying that, you know, you work so hard in the summer, and then when the winter comes, it's here, and it gives you time to soften up a little bit. But that's, even love does that. You know, you work so hard for something, and yet when you get it, you kind of fall soft, and you don't kind of work it as much as you used to, and you don't weed it as much as you should. And then when it comes, you know, and then when Santa comes for the cookies and the creams, you know, all the presents are there, and then, you know, so that all, you know, it's just a fairy tale. It all soon will pass, and that the tree slowly becomes a fire hazard. That's because you haven't watered it, and you haven't taken care of it, and it's just sitting there drying out as in a relationship. And unless you keep something watered, it's going to die. So you got to keep watering it. You got to keep it alive. You can't just let it just sit there. If not, you're going to burn it down. So excellent, excellent job.
Yeah, I really like that interpretation. Spot on. And Pam, your thoughts?
Yeah, this is an amazing brevity. It really packs a punch. As you said, it says so much in a few words. I do like the way the form that he did. I don't know if it's the exact form, but, you know, the way it kind of just flowed down as far as syllable count. The beginning line is especially important. The fact that he put a period at the end of it, I thought, you know, like separated on its own, made in a statement on its own. You think love comes easily. And all throughout, he reminds us that, you know, gardening and love and life all take patience and caring. But, you know, as Felon was touching upon, even with all our patience and caring, sometimes things don't turn out as we like. And then I thought there was a biting humor to the imagery of the tree slowly becomes a fire hazard, a nuisance at the curb, representing that love that just kind of has died and toppled over and needed to be dragged out to the curb. So excellent write and very well done.
Absolutely. Great comment. Yeah, boy, that's just such great poetry. As always, this is going to be a really tough one to judge. So, you know, better to have too many choices and the problem of poetry that is difficult to judge. And we are fortunate that this is another one of those contests. So, great job.
It is definitely
okay,
a good problem to have. And Felon, I've put your poem up next. So go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
Okay, I took prompt 3, which is naked speech, naked beggar, both blind and cold, wrap it for my sake in paisley shawls and bright soft fabric. And it goes like this, beggar of nothing. On display dead, sinner amongst my peers, left to stand on a soapbox of splinter stability, treading waters of silence with thin breaks. A blind dive into speaking my mind was a plunge into the coldest winter, teeth chattering SOS as words begin to drown, a dying speech from bare skin and bone. Expressing help doesn't mean make me a beggar. Shall I freeze or drown and surrounded by unmoved witnesses? As the breath takes on water, the cavalry arrives, fishing me to safety. Warmth him with the wool and knitted agenda, shelter provided in limitless, uneasy rest. Bearing nothing other than my name, the shell of me hidden beneath their sand. Welcomes the tide of cold hard truth, allow me to drown in the depths of myself. In points.
Wow. Yeah, I read all these things before the show, and this one just, it struck me when I read it the first time, and then to hear you read it just now really struck me again. It's just such a powerful piece. Shall I freeze or drown, surrounded by unmoved witnesses, as the breath takes on water? Cavalry arrives, fishing me to safety. Warmth hemmed with wool and a knitted agenda, shelter provided in a limitless, uneasy rest. It's just palpable. It's so painful and powerful metaphor. For me, it speaks of the pain of alienation in our society, where your protagonist is left to drown despite being surrounded by unmoved witnesses. I know that the cavalry fishing to safety is there, but it still seems like kind of just that world of, you know, here you are in this big city with millions of people, and yet everyone has their eyes averted to the problem or to someone in need of help. And that's how it felt to me. Just very well done. And Pam, your thoughts? Absolutely.
Yeah, I really like what you, well, first of all, Fallon, great read there. And I really like what you had to say, Richard, about the idea on how, you know, people can see a person drowning, see a person, you know, just struggling with life and completely ignore it. And I can definitely see that in this poem. And I thought this was definitely a hard hitting write. It was brilliant and emotive. It was hard hitting. I like how, you know, to me it spoke on the idea of the fear of exposing ourselves through our poetry and in other ways, and you know, not reaching anyone. But there is a I think if I had read it, had a chance to read it a couple times, I would have seen what you see, Richard. You know, sometimes it takes definitely more than one reading. But, you know, I like how, Fallon, you bring out through the imagery of winter and the imagery of being unsheltered, the idea of exposure. And I do especially like the second stanza, blind dive into speaking my mind was plunged in the coldest winter. Sometimes the words we have to say don't reach other people. And then the ending, bearing nothing other than my name that shows me hidden beneath their sand. You know, people want to take truth and bury it beneath the sand, almost like ostriches sticking their head in the sand. And sometimes they expect you to do the same thing, you know, so excellent write and very well done.
Thank you, Pam. I'll if I can give a brief explanation of it.
Absolutely.
You know, sometimes people want to just put you out there and they'll ask you your opinion or ask you your views on something, or they'll ask you to write something. And then when you express yourself and basically you give it everything that makes you you, and you tell some things that make you vulnerable. It's like the sharks are just out there feasting, and that's the fin breaks. There's always those sharks out there just waiting for a moment to just feast on you, and yet you're sitting there drowning, and you know, you're sitting there, and the ones that you think should, you know, come to your, you know, your rescue are just watching you like, okay, well, bye. And then it comes down to this. The ones that fish you out, they got an agenda behind it. They wanted to look like they're the, they're your savior, but at the same time, they are just leaving you in this cold, hard cell on a concrete floor. Yeah, they might have gave you something to curl up to, but I'd rather go back to that cold water and drown instead of living or being in the moment of what they're putting me in, and that's basically holding me prisoner to my own words. So that's just that's what it's about.
Thanks for that, Felon. That actually makes a lot of sense now. And that's the thing about your poems is that they have such depth that, it takes a couple of reads, and it never hurts to hear the poet explaining their work. So much appreciated. Absolutely. And where would you like to go now, Pam?
All right, Richard, I put your poem up. Go ahead and give it a read for us, please.
Ah, okay. So I went through your prompts, Pam, and I saw one that was definitely me. So there's one prompt that says, "Let us come upon him first as if in a dream." And I've always been inspired by dreams. I just feel like they are just such a wonderful inspiration for writing. So I took a shot and wrote this one. It's called "As If in a Dream." You rushed down river. Kaleidoscopic prisms arced and danced in your wake. My throat opened and drank your pulsing light near drowning in your tight wound red frills. Pursued by a Crisco-dipped golden demon who eludes my zip-tie shackles and hovers in shadows for her red frills to surface. Out from the mud-caked manhole, I cling to her stiletto heels. Still on entering his sunken 60s den, she's vanished. My cold, sweating palms twist the leaf-shaped brass doorknob like blinds as I shed the abandoned A-frame. Song's house numbers or cell signal lost. End of poem.
Great read there, Richard. I'm so glad you were inspired by that prompt. And Felon, start with your thoughts.
I'm still trying to digest it because there's a lot to it. I'll be honest, I'm a little lost with it, Richard. And maybe it's just maybe it's my night medicine's kicking in too. That's when that starts doing it. I can't have a clear thought for nothing. But what I'm gathering is that because with the prompt it says, "Let us come upon him first, as in if it were a dream." It's almost like it's, and I know I'm probably way off base here. It's almost like a man dressing in a woman's stilettos, and, you know, it's just all a facade, but yet, you know, my cold, sweaty palms twist the leaf-shaped brass doorknob. It's almost like he's coming in to surprise her, like, look at me. But that's what I gather from it. I'm probably way off base, but if not, I really like to know what it's about. I'm sorry.
That's okay. So yeah, and just so you know, whenever I do these dream surrealist poems, I like to make them layered so that they're open to multiple interpretations. So I love that interpretation. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. A wonderful comment there, Felon. I liked your observations. You know, I do enjoy, Richard, that when you delve into the surrealism type style, that works really well with this particular quote. I love the strong imagery in this, especially it's so visceral. Pursued by a Crisco-dipped golden demon, which eludes my zip-tie shackles and hovers in shadows. Yeah, like when I see the word Crisco, I just think of something, it's Crisco dipped. It's like you think of something just oily looking and you know, just slippery. Like it's so creative. I never thought of it before, but it just is a perfect choice of words And there's an intensity to this that you bring us into this dream world. And I like that because the dreams oftentimes represent, especially nightmares, represent our subconscious fears or, you know, things that we want to avoid, but our subconscious won't let us. I really like the intensity of my cold, sweating palms twist the leaf-shaped brass knob, light blinds, and I shed the abandoned A-frame house numbers or cell single lost. And I like that you end with that one word, lost, like the awareness that you don't know where you are and there's no guidance. So powerful, right, and very well done. And
thanks
did
so
you
much,
want to
Pam.
Say anything?
I love writing about dreams. I feel like there's always a good opening for conflict. So without going too deep into it, I feel like all good writing involves conflict. And then when you're in a nightmare, there's always conflict. There's always the protagonist, who is usually you, and then some kind of pursuer or opponent or enemy that you're either running from or you're fighting or somehow subduing. And so, you know, I love the idea that it's a slippery demon that I can't shackle, which is nightmarish. And then leaving that house where the demon and that woman is, instead of being free. I mean, I am free, but I'm also lost, which is quite nightmarish too. And just nightmares in general just fascinate me. And I never tire of writing of them. I just think they're just such a rich vein for the writer to delve into, especially since it deals with fear.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
very cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yep. So I was inspired.
Awesome.
Okay, Pam.
And I have gone ahead and put my poem up next. It's called The Dementia of Truth Slade, and it goes like this. In small towns, we discover bones of ourselves trying desperately to drift away. Beneath burnt trees, swaddled seedlings stretch to crown wet leaves. Prophets of gossip gnash their polymer teeth against white fence lines to know the holy dementia of a truth slayed for greater purpose. An antiquity of words blends together, raised to be filth and famine in promises of jukebox rivalry. Onward we march, waving ash-covered palms to a Wednesday of up-and-coming debutantes, revealing knickers drop to satiate the bowl in a pen of stalwart tomorrows, gorging ourselves upon dreams of city light that electrify the pinpoints of self. Among the stench of evergreens, we rest to trace the naked words that pierce the eye, ties for the trimmings of ornamental holidays, orchid scriptures to mason the veins of Venus sinking below the waves, lost in the apocalypse mind. Roots require a sacred breath. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Okay, Fallon, if we could start off with you, what'd you think?
Wow. Well, you bring it, Pam, you really bring it. The dementia of truth slayed. The truth is what we have in life. And basically, you know, we start off with small towns, we discover bones of ourselves. And sometimes we just bury that self there because we don't want, when we move out to go somewhere else, we don't want to take what may be poverty or disparities or anything that we have that would make us look weak in anyone else's eyes. We want to bury that deep within that, under that tree that where we grew up. And it's, you know, the burnt, beneath the burnt trees, the swaddled seedings. And that's where we start, you know, planting our own lives and planting our own trees that root to who we are. And then the prophets of gossip, basically, you know, it's what we're taught as children as far as the scripture. And, you know, if we don't do this, it's hell and damnation against us. And there goes all the white picket fence that we thought we was going to have. And then we, you know, the holiness of the mention of the truth that's slayed is for the greater purposes. The truth is sometimes it's your own relationship with God and not anybody else's. And it's your spiritual praising that matters. And it's what you have with him. And then you go into the infinity of words that blend together. You know, it sometimes we do. They see things as filth and flame, which it's not. And who is agreeing to do it? If you're both, you know, partying with people that want to do it together, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. So on we march, you know, and then go on and on. It is like the ornaments, the tines of for the trimming of the trees, and you know, just wow. The apocalypse mind roots require a sacred breath. You know, sometimes we live dead in our own minds, and then the roots, we need that one breath that's going to bring things together. So, wow, amazing poem.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Great comment, Thelen. I loved your interpretation, and I think it added another dimension to my understanding of the poem. So I actually read this one a few times, Pam, and after I think the third read, I came up with a take, and it goes like this. I think it's an offering on societal constraints and the pressure to conform, even if that means the truth must be sacrificed on conformity's altar. As always, your metaphors are intricately weaved to your purpose, and your lyricism is compelling. And I loved your comment, which was, thank you very much, as opposed to, yes, you're spot on, or no, that was totally off, because it enables us to ask the question on the air.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, well, you know, I tend to respond that way just because, you know, I just, you know, don't necessarily want to tell people they're wrong or right. Plus, I do try to write a bit layered. I mean, you know, even like Neutron's comment, and I won't read the whole thing, but she says, it points to the fact that the grass is not always greener and pastures not yet seen. The anonymity is hard to maintain, and your dirty laundry or knickers may be on display to speak living in a country town. You know, so I love the fact that all three of you had different points of views. And I really honestly can't say that any one of you are wrong. Because, you know, I do put in here the idea that small towns are a place of gossip, you know, and with prophets of gossip gnash the palm of teeth against white fence lines. And the idea that so oftentimes, especially as youth, we want to escape that kind of atmosphere. But that, you know, the gorging ourselves upon dreams of city life that electrify the pinpoints of self, there is within a bigger city this sense of self-destruction. And oftentimes, you know, things aren't always as they're supposed to be, you know. And I have to say, though, when Thelen brought up the part about how, you know, we're raised in a certain way of religion and how it's supposed to be, that really touched me because, with the lines, and I knew it would be difficult to understand, but orchid scriptures to mason the veins of Venus sinking below the waves, especially spoke on that because, okay, and then I partially wrote this to amuse myself, you know, I didn't expect anybody to understand it, but I learned yesterday, you know, on just wandering around reading stuff, that the word orchid comes from the Greek word orchis, which literally translates as testicle. So by putting that together, I was talking about, and this is the feminist in me coming out, is the idea of male-dominated religion that put that stone, those mason stones, into the veins of the feminine energy and causes it to sink. And so we need to, you know, instead of being lost in that, we need to take and that sacred breath, that cleansing breath. So, you know, that's some of the, you know, so really honestly, I have to say that none of you were wrong because there is so much of each one of those comments in this, and it is about that whole idea of, you know, trying to escape from, you know, the truth that people shove down at us. So thank you.
Awesome. Great. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Felon. We really appreciated you hanging out. You always add so much to these shows.
All right, guys. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, have a good
care.
Night.
Thank you.
Bye.
Okay, bye. All right, Pam. So,
all right.
So now it's a conversation between the two of us.
All right, so we're going to have to kind of lengthen out our, not too much, we have 40 minutes left, but yeah, we'll have to make our comments slightly longer.
Yeah, that's okay.
All right, well, up next we have Joker by Neutron Bomb, and will you go ahead, Richard, and give that a read, please?
Absolutely. Okay, so Neutron wrote to the same prompt that I did, which was, let us come upon him first as if in a dream. And she wrote a poem called Joker. Meditating on medication, the water runs down his cheek, his desolation encompassed by a pothole turned sinkhole, which swallows him whole. Spiders saunter up through the bitumen, fashioning a web of silk over his wounds. Modern-day maggots that steal the hide. Society would see a clown bearing a tear tattoo, walloped with a sign of the time, suckling on the ruby red of paper roses, their innervated shells, flummox the skin with goosebumps. He wakes during the witching hour, twitching, turning, chest beating, eyes dilated, waiting for an interminable banging at the door, dreamscapes of hammers knocking. The clown resigns himself with sloping shoulders, waiting for the final nail to be slammed into the cerebral cortex. Okay, Pam, what'd you think of this one?
Well, you know, Neutron's poetry always impresses me. She has such strong imagery and metaphors. And, you know, it's always fascinating to me to see two poets write to the same prompt and have, similar and yet different takes. I like the imagery of his desolation encompassed by a pothole turned sinkhole, like that idea of, you know, how in dream world, you know, something can be safe one moment and then not the next. Modern day maggots that steal the hide. Society would see a clown bearing a tear tattoo walloped with a sign of the times. You know, I like how she separates a sign of the times and makes us realize that, you know, this in current times, it's basically like a witch hunt. I get the imagery in my mind of the witch hunt with the villagers with the pitchforks and the torches. I also really like dreamscapes of hammers knocking. That is a line that has a very, who is the Dolly, the artist Dolly. It makes me think of his art. And the clown resigns himself with sloping shoulders, waiting for the final nail to be slammed. This so much speaks on our fear of and realization that society does not accept those who are different. So amazing take on the prompt and very well done.
Absolutely, Pam. Yeah, you know, There was a Hitchcock film where he hired slash collaborated with Dolly. I forget what it was called, and I don't want to get it wrong, but yeah, and it's a dream scene. And I think that Neutron really nailed it. The fluidity of a dream, where as you insightfully said, something safe turns into something unsafe, pothole turns into a sinkhole. And then also that fluidity is taken with the wordplay, which swallows him whole. It's just, you know, it's a beautiful thing how dreams are so malleable and fluid like that. And a hard thing to really write to skillfully, and she just nails it. I think that it's just so seamless and very accessible. You immediately get that whole dream feel to it. And I just love how she did it. You know, she's one of my favorite poets on this site. And it was a hell of a portrait of the realm of the nightmare. And I really love that close. Dreamscapes of hammers knocking. The clown resides himself with sloping shoulders, waiting for the final nail to be slammed into the cerebral cortex. And it has that whole nightmarish psychiatric medicine gone bad, you know? Really powerful and very dark and very well done. So just a great offering. I'm so happy that she wrote to it. Even though she couldn't be with us on the air, she's here with us with her work. And with that, I guess we'll move on to our next one.
Absolutely. You know, and that is one of the things I appreciate about Neutron. Even when she has to miss a show, like, she's there, like you said, in her writing. So that is very cool.
Yep.
Yeah. And up next, we have Asylum by David Philip Ireland, and that one has a recording.
Yep. Okay. I will pull it.
Asylum by David Philip Ireland. The bleached walls unread are an asylum of sightless eyes, a morgue for the undead, the comatized. Graffiti arrows directionalize, pointing their gaze at the artless skim as if, of all places, art has no place here at all. No music plays in this brilliant hall, no decibels vibrate the air, just the sobbing of the jailer who holds your life at bay. The murderous taint of invisible liquor clouds the mind and steals the spine and what's left of the resolve. Resolutions are transient. The power of will, weak in significance. The decisions falter at hurdles as yet unimagined. Survival is the only option.
Well, holy hell, that SoundCloud took it to a whole other level. When David wrote for the contest, I read the poem and he said, I'm going to add a SoundCloud. So just giving me a heads up. And I loved it. I love when the SoundClouds are not just a recitation, but instead they are a performance piece. And the performance actually adds to the poem. And there's no question about it. That first stanza is kind of in the realm of normalcy. And then stanza two, he has the reverb and it gets more pronounced as the poem goes on until in the finale, it's like a total deconstruction, and you know, and we're kind of lost in the asylum with the poet. So I thought that was a whole other level that was brought. Before that occurred, I read it as a poem, and I thought it had some compelling lyricism, and that the lyricism actually aided in driving home the dark and vivid word painting of the asylum. Very well done piece. And Pam, what do you think?
Well, great observations there, Richard. Yeah, the audio really added to the depth of the write, especially with his choice of doing a slow, purposeful read and, you know, adding in that haunting background music. I like that he takes us into this asylum, and I feel like in part the asylum is an extended metaphor for life. And main thought I got from this was that it was a dark and haunting rite that speaks on the despair that comes from the death of art. And that came to me with that stanza that starts with, "No music plays in this brilliant hall, no decibels vibrate the air, just the sobbing of the jailer who holds your life at bay." And this can definitely be taken literally about a rite about an asylum. But there's also this idea, you know, of it representing life and of rights being taken away, or of music and art being taken away, and how life, the spirit, goes into despair. So excellent write and very well done.
I love that interpretation, kind of like a Simon Garfunkel Sounds of Silence. Yeah, I can see that now that you pointed it out. It's a beautiful thing that we do here on the air, where we discuss these poems.
I do enjoy it. Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's amazing. Yeah, because, you know, there's no way that one person can get a read on a poem and interpret it the same way that six people can. So it's a great thing.
Yeah.
Much
appreciated. It's great to have different perspectives. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, one of the reasons I decided to go with Basil Bunting, besides the fact that I like his poetry, is the fact that he often emphasized the importance of reading poetry out loud. And I thought, well, that's just perfect for us. You know, that's what we do. We make sure poetry gets read out loud.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and that's why even when I can't make it to one of these LNP shows, I always try and add a sound class. So.
Yes, for sure.
Okay.
All right. Up next we have Assaulted by Weaver of Dreams, and we have a recording for that.
Okay. I am pulling it. Okay, here it comes. Oops, for some reason it didn't play. Let me try that again.
When I sleep, I move into another realm, inhabited by dream figures, good and bad. My sturdy companion, gigantic and green, is a magnificent lion who deems it a privilege to carry me on his back hither and thither. I have a foe determined to bar me from here. On his own, he is useless. A slimy, slippery slug, vile-colored and slow. But when all are gathered in their thousands, the thought of them climbing all over me simply makes me want to flee. I'd hatched a plan. Each night I returned here, I brought a sack of salt. Tonight I journeyed to the dark and dank cave they hid in, and threw salt inside and out. I left when I heard the sound of slugs dissolving. I took back my dream realm.
Thank you for the SoundCloud Weaver of Dreams. Okay, Pam, what'd you think?
Oh, this was just clever. And did she write to the same, Yep, she did. That's what I thought. She wrote to the same prompt that you and Neutron did. Very cool. First of all, wonderful wordplay with that title, A and then dash and then the word salted. So, you know, it's really clever. I like how this delves into a dream world and yet at the same time tells a story. I have a foe determined to bar me from here. On his own, he is useless, a slimy, slippery slug. That's really great alliteration. But when all are gathered in their thousands, the thought of them climbing all over me simply makes me want to flee. I like that that's from the perspective of, it reminds us that, when one person alone isn't going to be able to necessarily do anything, but gathered together, they're a force. And of course, I like that she brings in the idea of sprinkling the salt on the slugs. And I'm always a big fan of poetry that brings in salt. You know, it's been a preserver since the beginning of time. It's got nutritional value. It creates balance. You know, there's something about salt and what it can represent. And here it represents the end of the nightmare, the power to, destroy to dissolve that nightmare. So excellent write and very well done.
Excellent comments there, Pam. Yeah, I too really love this piece. I thought it was, as you said, a great story. And the subject matter, lucid dreaming, how you take control of the dream, which is not an easy thing to do. I've had moments of lucid dreaming, but to do it on any consistent basis, I don't know. It takes more practice, I guess, than I have been able to muster so far in this lifetime. But when it is done, it truly is like reclaiming one's power after being kind of just battered about in life's hurricane, in this dreamland hurricane. Suddenly you're empowered and you're taking control, taking back the dream. I love that. And the journey of the dreamer towards self-empowerment was so nicely done. And also the fact that it's being done with these slugs is kind of just, it's one thing to do it to a demon or a pack of dogs, normal nightmarish things that we encounter. But the slugs, it's kind of taking the whole thing and taking the bite out of the nightmare, I think. So it was nice. Nice change of pace in this kind of somewhat dark and serious contest.
and Chia's Weaver is very good at that, at putting that little bit of twist, that nice humor that's needed, so very cool.
Absolutely. Okay, I see we have our next one up.
Yes, Urban Landscape by Gerald E. Green, and we have an audio for that.
Okay, let me pull that.
Urban Landscape, written in red by Gerald Green. Ghettos build their own society, like a Serengeti bull charting new paths in urban scrub. Each generation moving farther from the one before, from mainstream thought and standards of sobriety. The ghetto thrives in its dust bowl of despair. Outside forces soon arrive, strive to bend what will not soon comply, arresting those they can, as if the few will change the many. Incarceration of the weak makes new disparity that grows with every move of authority. Drugs and human trafficking thriving in the night. The ghetto thrives in its dust bowl of despair. Lids of boiling pots bounce, letting steam release that dissipates and can't be traced. Men with badges patrol expanding perimeters to feed a hungry justice system. No one thinks to fertilize the barren land or irrigate parched fields, so fences try to hold what can't be held. The ghetto thrives in its dust bowl of despair. A gun becomes the final arbiter, replacing long-forgotten laws, where productivity cannot breathe and respect for life is redefined in Shadows University. Safety flees like frightened sheep, as if black and white cars do not exist. Each year a few bright lights escape, children fleeing from a tenement's fire, who suckle wisdom's milk, overcoming urban's pull, never returning or looking back. But the ghetto thrives on its dust bowl of despair. End poem.
Wow, what a read, what a voice. You know, he has that kind of professional narration voice where there's just this silky smooth, flawless narration, and it just added a whole other dimension to the piece, which is very much appreciated. So I did write some stuff, but I guess I think we do have the time, I'm going to just kind of riff off of how this hit me personally, because my dad, so I did not grow up in a ghetto. Actually, I grew up in the suburbs of New York City, and where I grew up was actually called the Gilded Ghetto. It's a town called Great Neck that F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote about in The Great Gatsby. He changed the name of the town to call it West Egg and East Egg, and West Egg was the new money. So that's where I grew up. But my dad came from the real ghetto. He came from Brooklyn during the 1930s, during the Great Depression. And so I know a lot about ghettos. And it spoke to me personally when he wrote the lines, "Each year a few bright lights escape. Children fleeing a tenement's fire, who suckle wisdom's milk, overcoming urban's pull, never returning or looking back. But the ghetto thrives on its dust bowl of despair." And that was really my dad's story, was that he grew up in a tenement and in, you know, this dust bear. And it really kind of wounded him throughout his life, even later when he was affluent. But he did escape, and it was truly wisdom's milk. It was the fact that he educated himself, that he, you know, went to university and eventually, you know, taught at New York University. But that whole thing of the ghetto of despair, and that the ghetto lives on, even though a couple can escape, that the institution is still there. So so that's how it hit me. And your thoughts, Pam?
Well, first of all, I really like that you shared that personal note and how the poem really just hit you and touched you personally. You know, this is a powerful write. I like how he has that repeating line, "The ghetto thrives in its dust bowl of despair," which really just keeps driving home the idea that the ghetto continues on in that sense of despair. And the idea that nobody is really doing anything, you know, I like all this all the way through. It's definitely a brilliant write, but I like the imagery of lids of boiling pots bounce, letting steam release, it dissipates and can't be traced. Men with badges patrol, expanding perimeters to feed a hungry justice system. No one thinks to fertilize the barren land. You know, so to me that speaks on the idea of patrolling the area and you know, making sure that laws are followed in the moment, which of course is important, but forgetting that there's so much deeper problems to be taken care of. You know, I also write like a gun becomes the final arbiter, replacing long forgotten laws. Oh my goodness, those are such impactful lines. So beautifully written and very well done.
Absolutely. Great insights, Pam. Okay. Where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next, we have, let me make sure I click on this so I have the full title. Lord, an offering to the Lord for Vyasa Puja presented at the new Raman Reti Temple by Liquid Mind Forever. And go ahead, Richard, and give that a read, please.
Okay. So, yeah, this is Liquid Mind Forever. It's called Lord, an offering to the Lord for Vyasa Puja presented at the new Raman Reti Temple. Lord, I come to you this night, offering a humble prayer of gratitude. Creator of all the worlds, cause of all causes, for your glory, Lord, hear my heart's song. You are my rock, my fortress, guarded, protected, sheltered, but not hidden, the changeless now, the absolute truth. It doesn't matter how difficult the journey seems, how exposed the heart must be. For until you come to the doorstep of one's heart, knocking, waiting, breaking down all walls of resistance, melting all obstacles to peace, we circle, suffering endlessly while we wait, wait for redemption, redemption that never seems to come. When our hearts, our minds surrender, beckon, and you bid you stay, then, Lord, in receptive silence, you arise when the seeds of faith germinate into racings of friendship, then on the stem of patience, your petals of grace embrace me. You awaken all my centers, releasing eternal springs of bliss within this soul. Though love resides within, peace must be earned. When no one and nothing comforts me, only your word, written upon ancient scrolls, bold texts of sacred script unfold to grant me peace. You, supreme benefactor, source that of all that is, only your mellifluous song stills this restless heart. You are love's celestial rhapsody, the longest and the shortest step, the most narrow and straight way to freedom. Your pure essence, your ineffable spirit resides at the core in the fiber of my soul's eternal quest. With unquenchable thirst, unsatisfied hunger, I come, surrendered, kneeling at your feet. The holy altar of holy silence in absolute knowing fast, holding fast to your word, and in your name I proclaim this journey, this quest will is leading me on the only true pathway home. End of poem. Okay, Pam, what'd you think?
Well, first of all, that was a wonderful read there. Liquid Mind Forever, her poetry always impresses me. And I like, I have to say, I thought it was very cool in her AUN where she says, I wrote this for Vyasa Bhuja and read it in front of the new Ramen Ready Temple, and it was on air. One of the devotees came up to me and said, inspirational. What a wonderful moment that must have been in life. And she wrote, well, she provided this, pre-write with for the prompt, the mystic purchases a moment of exhilaration with a lifetime of confusion. I thought it worked really well with that prompt. It was a great choice of a pre-write to put in. A wonderful spiritual write on the search for truth, and the process of the journey. I apologize. I didn't really get to read as much of the poetry ahead of time as I would have liked to. But still this one has an impact. And I do like that that stanza, it doesn't matter how difficult the journey seems, how exposed the heart must be for until you come to the doorstep of one's heart knocking, waiting, breaking down all walls of resistance. So the power, that's within inside of us. And even, she mentions the heart again, when our heart, our mind surrender, beckons and bid, when the seeds of faith germinate. We go searching for answers in outside sources, and so many times that answer is inside of us. So beautifully written and very well done.
Excellent comment. Yeah, it's a powerful piece, a strong devotional prayer. And I love poetic prayers. It was actually, I think it was my first poems, but it was in the early days of me writing poetry that I wrote a book of poetic prayers. And it's a very powerful practice, especially since they are intoned aloud. I mean, that's the purpose of them. So you kind of bring them to life by reciting them aloud. And this one was quite uplifting throughout. I especially liked Your Love Celestial Rhapsody, the longest and shortest step, the most narrow and straight way to freedom. I thought that was really powerful. And, a good take on the prompt, because it is quite a mystical, devotional, poetic prayer. It has the ring of truth to it and throughout it. And I truly felt that ring when I was reading it before the show, and even more so when I read it aloud here just now on the air. So great job there, Deborah. Much appreciated. Okay, Pam, I'm thinking probably one more.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too, and then we'll have you'll have a couple of carryovers. All right.
See
so
that?
Our last poem for the night is a koan, The Limitations of Language on the Bluntness of Humanity's Sharpest Tool by Eric Daniel Herman. Linguistic cunning lists as the emergence of pure poeticus out of phonetic oral sex comes lyrical transcendence. Acacia thorns pierce the skin while shittim pierces the veil of the perceivable as golden incense weaves across the sky to a sanctuary where we unwind space and time. Prophets write of the vapor turning on lights and horns shining in rays of synesthesia, magi mixed herbs under the desert moon, which mapped a path through golden the sand. Bundles of wild harmal woods burns as sparks flicker and dance with stars and a moon reaching bonfire. Under autumn shadows in the harmonic hum of the aboriginal didgeridoo drifting on the streams of wattle seed smoke, gazing down as the earth unfolds and refolds in somatic origami card trick, out of the soil grows the ship which flies above the starry skies, fruit of biblical implications, with seeds of knowledge and keys to ghostly dimensions. Thomas Aquinas and Meister Eckhart shared the same eye as you and I. Peel wide the smoke screen and spy through the looking glass used by God, which saw God, which was the eye through which the Son of God saw and wept the stale state of the collective unconscious thoughts, lost in spirals of consumption and mirror reflection masturbation. This is not the godless wasteland advertised by the screaming anchormen, fearmongers, and alarmists who sell panic by the gallon. With electrodes probing their temporal lobes, the prophets and shamans are in the asylums, labeled as schizos for their visions of angels and demons and messages from gods. An amnesiac species chasing the neurochemical highs shaped by evolutionary design as a means to survive. Barrel of monkeys biologically swinging about nuclear-powered technology, alienated that far removed from nature, forest, desert, ocean, planning to leave the planet entirely. Om Mani Padme Hung, Om, Om Mani Padme Hung, Om, and poem.
Wonderful read there, Pam, and not an easy poem to read. I like that we are ending the evening with two very, very spiritual poems in a row here. Boy, this was really something. It was one of those kind of just tour de force poems where we're just given a wide-angle scope on the human condition and the nature of things. I found it rich and surreal, hard to do justice in a few words, but I will say that this is a poem that truly speaks and speaks volumes. I felt it was like a shining star on art's lonely hilltop, and truly praiseworthy. I see it as a pending pick. And again, that speaks to the talent of our community and the poems that we inspire in this show. And I don't know, I was just kind of dumbstruck by the talent and the depth of this poem. And I'm interested to hear your thoughts.
Oh my goodness, yes, a tour de force is the perfect way to describe this. And this is wonderfully spiritual and surreal. I really like that title, The Limitations of Language, and the idea of how there's so much in this world and beyond this world that we don't see, that we don't accept or appreciate. And those who are true prophets, we often deem as crazy. Those who see beyond the ordinary. I really liked that part there. I also liked the mention of the fearmongers and alarmists. We do oftentimes live in a world of fearmongering, and we forget what's truly important. We forget the history of the world and those things that are important to remember. So brilliant, brilliant write with its surrealism and food for thought, and very well done. Uh-oh, Richard, are you still there? Are you on mute? Richard?
Oops, I was on mute. Sorry about that. I'm back. Okay, we're running out of time, but I wanted to plug your show. It's coming up in a half an hour. Please tune in for that. Call in. And I want to thank you, Pam. Thank Felon for joining us. And most of all, to thank all the poets that write for us every 2 weeks. Please join us in a couple of weeks for our Halloween special on Haunted New Orleans. And with any luck at all, Neutron Bomb will be back. Okay, thanks so much for joining us, and thank you, Pam.